The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And good morning and welcome to this January 23rd edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You can subscribe to us. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. So happy to be doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock a.m. One housekeeping issue before we get started today. There is a speaker series event coming up next month, February 5th. I mentioned this today because these tickets are really selling out pretty quickly. Pam Houston is going to be there, so it promises to sell out quickly. If you go on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, you can find out details about that. Of course, you can always follow us on Facebook. You can follow us apparently on Twitter. We're all over the place. Anyway, I'm spending the full hour this morning with Tim O'Brien, and I pre-recorded this just a couple of days ago, so let's dive into that now. Tim O'Brien is the author of Going After Cacciato, which received the National Book Award in Fiction, and The Things They Carried, which was a finalist for both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. In the Lake of the Woods was named Best Novel of the Year by Time magazine in 1994. O'Brien's other books are If I Die in a Combat Zone, Northern Lights, The Nuclear Age, Tomcat in Love, and July, July. His short fiction has appeared in numerous literary and popular magazines. In 97, he won the National Magazine Award for the short story The Things They Carried. And in 99, the same story was selected for inclusion in the Best American Short Stories of the Century. There's more to be said, including his consulting work on This Is Us, and more importantly, the 18-hour PBS documentary series on the Vietnam War by Ken Burns and Lynn Novak. Hopefully, perhaps we'll have time to talk about all of that. But Tim, welcome.
I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. So I'll begin with a confession. We've been bringing writers on the show who may not necessarily have new work out, but they've been otherwise, you know, people we've loved and we've somehow missed. And you're a friend of Andre Debus's, which is how we got connected together. But, you know, I've kind of quietly stalked you for more personal reasons. I can't remember if I've shared on the show that my dad, you know, we've done, I don't know, a couple of books on Vietnam. My dad was a vet and died about 18 months ago. So I have just found myself sort of seeking out men in the last year, you know, men of his ilk and other vets, and I've just been sharing stories with them and whatnot. So it means even more for me to have you on today. This is
I'm so glad to hear it.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it was funny. I mean, when I was growing up, the war just felt like this, like animal, like this living, breathing sort of animal in the corner of our house. And, you know, my dad was a talker. He wrote a lot of letters and he was a great storyteller. But, I started wondering as I was revisiting this book again, The Things They Carried again this year, if the men who talked, if you notice the difference between the men who told stories and who shared their stories versus the men who were pretty silent, if you feel like there's sort of a difference in their approach or their recovery or their, you know, kind of mental state about the war.
Well, veterans fall silent for a variety of reasons. It's not always just psychological trauma. Sometimes I go silent because I want to be polite and not bother people with my problems or talk a lot about the war. You don't go to a cocktail party or a dinner party and say you want to hear about Vietnam. It's kind of a party pooper. And simple politeness and not wanting to bother people is one thing. Another thing is that it's difficult to know what to talk about. Where do you start? Do you start back when you were drafted or even earlier? Or do you start in the midst of the war? Or do you start with this story or that story? There's so much that's compressed into the combat experience that you sort of thrash around in your head with something to say that is a starting point. And then to find an ending point is also hard to do. Where do you stop? And it's difficult simply in terms of memory as well. At my age, I'm 72 now, a lot of Vietnam has vanished. It's the way my childhood has vanished. It was long ago, and a few things remain, images and a 20-second firefight might last in memory. But there's a lot of empty time, too, vast stretches of time that has gone into the fog of history, and it's hard to retrieve it. That plays in, too, when it comes to the issue of silence. And then there's the final problem of you don't want to hurt people. If you have a daughter or a son, you don't want to cause stress or pain to them by talking about your own problems. And you don't want to upset your wife or your girlfriend or your boyfriend unnecessarily by revisiting the emotions of, in my case, 45, 50 years ago. And then, of course, there is the psychological trauma thing that I started with. There is that it's difficult and painful to go backward to moments of incredible horror and tragedy, and the pain of revisiting those moments is a little bit like picking a scab. It hurts, and it bleeds, and it's uncomfortable. So all that goes into silence. I'm a pretty silent guy, too, when it comes to Vietnam. On an interview such as this one, I'll talk about it. But ordinarily, I don't talk about it much. I've written about it, and maybe that's been my outlet or my vent to do it on paper.
Right, right. Yeah, it's funny. My experience was a little bit different because I think a lot of these guys came back and nobody wanted to talk about it. Their wives didn't want to talk about it. It wasn't like World War II where, you know, you came back and had a big parade and everybody was proud of you. And so I was really little. I mean, I was born 2 years after he came back. A little kid is a good audience because they'll just sit there and listen to all your stories. So, you know, drink and tell me all these stories because right. I was the one that sat there and listened to them. So.
That's a good point you make, and that Vietnam veterans did not come home as veterans came home from, say, World War II, where you came home in a big group of people on a troop ship, maybe 1,000 at a time. We came home pretty much one by one. We would the day would come when we would leave the war, and we'd go take a shower and fly to an airport on a helicopter and then board a plane with maybe 150, 200 guys on it. And then as soon as we returned to the States, we'd disperse. Mm. We'd get on separate airplanes and go to our hometowns. So there wasn't this en masse return that would generate parades through New York City or San Francisco or wherever. We were coming home man by man and going to our hometowns. So we didn't get the confetti, and we didn't get the ticker tape and the tubas playing and the trombones. It was a quiet, much more quiet return.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I didn't much want a parade in my own case.
Yeah.
I had enough parades in the Army and enough inspections and enough of that shoe-shining stuff. All I wanted was to go home and find my life again.
Yeah, yeah. So you were born, I had read that you were interested in writing all the way along, even before the war. Even as a little boy, you read a lot. And I was kind of interested in what you wrote pre-Vietnam and if you still see any kind of relics of what had interested you before this kind of took over your life, you know?
Well, I really didn't write much at all. I wanted to be a writer from the time I was a little boy, but it seemed an impossible thing to do. It seemed to me that writers lived in New York or Los Angeles and not in a little cow town in the middle of nowhere. That was wrong, of course. So many great writers come from towns much like mine, small towns. But as a boy, it didn't seem that way. It seemed that it was an impossible dream. So although I wanted to write and although I read a lot as a kid, it was a way of escape and a way of leaving a humdrum life behind through books, having adventures and so on. I really didn't do very much. I just dreamed about someday doing it. And it wasn't until Vietnam collided with my life when I was 22 years old or so that I felt I had anything worth writing about. And then I began pretty seriously.
Do you, I love how your childhood home, you know, kind of still collides with a lot of your stories. And I always feel like writers can't get away from their place of origin, that place where you didn't quite have language yet for it. So it felt everything, you know, you're tapping into that kind of pre-verbal stuff, psychological stuff, and using all of that in, you know, juxtaposed against Vietnam. I just loved all of that. You're right. Those small towns are so evocative, way more than New York, I think. It's great. So let's talk a little bit about one of the things that I really loved in revisiting this, and I had kind of forgotten about, are how many writerly lessons are in the things they carried. There's, you know, just wonderful passages, sort of not just about the war, but about your kind of theories of writing. And there's a great passage about how Rat tells these stories, and he has a tendency to stop now and then and interrupt the flow and insert these little clarifications and bits of analysis and personal opinion, and, you know, what a bad habit that is for writers. And
right. You're right. The thing they carried, like probably all my writing, is partly about the process of writing itself, just partly, but it is in there. And it's the struggle to get things right, the struggle we all have when someone asks a question and you try to answer as briefly as you can, but and as economically as you can, but also as clearly as you can and as forcefully and vividly as you can. So it's a constant struggle, not just for a writer, but I think for all of us, to how we say things and how we try to make whoever is listening to us feel something of what we felt back when this experience was happening. And it's a difficult thing to do, to make people feel what it is to have breast cancer or to have a father and mother divorce. You can approach it through cliches and stereotype and melodrama and that sort of thing, but you don't want to. You want to make it feel real and vivid and have the emotions in your stomach correspond to what the emotions were that you went through way back when the event happened. But for me, writing fiction is essentially about making people feel things, fear and the joy of being alive after a firefight, the immense aliveness that you feel, and that it's a sense of emotion that I'm hoping to generate in a reader. And it's a difficult thing to do, and so I sometimes stop and say, boy, I'm having trouble here, and I'm not sure you're feeling what I'm feeling.
Do you have, can you say more about how you go about transmitting that emotion without devolving into sentimentality or, well, certainly cliche and stereotype, but it's very, is it more like reporting of the facts and focusing on the details and stripping out the emotion? Or did you have any kind of tips and tricks on how to write trauma?
I see what you're saying. I think it's really a detail that does it. Instead of saying, boy, that was a terrible day, you don't use the word terrible and you don't use the word day. You just simply write about what occurred. One could say, for example, that Vietnam was full of racism. But instead of using the word racism, you display it, you show it. You show a lieutenant tying an old 80-year-old man to a tree and banging him in the shins with a pistol over and over and over. And you hear him yelling bad words, and you hear see the words in dialogue. And you describe the old man's face, and you describe the anger on the lieutenant's face. And by displaying the scene, you're showing racism, and you're showing violence, and you're showing the nasty side of war without using words like nasty or the word violent. And by trying to display things through events and dialogue and so on, as opposed to in an analytical kind of way.
Yeah. Do you remember the very origin, sitting down to write the short story of the things they carried, and if it always started the way it started, or how did you kind of find your way into that? Was that always the beginning?
I remember it the way I remember the rest of my life, which is sort of. I mean, that's how I remember yesterday, is sort of.
Right.
Even this morning, I remember sort of. I have images of physical pictures in my head of moments during the composition of that first chapter, the things they carried. And the struggle was not on the things a reader might expect. It wasn't over what to write, but it was a sentence-by-sentence struggle with language. I wanted the sound of the prose to be this, have the cadences of in unending march, kind of plodding, carrying the weights, getting heavier and heavier. And so on a lot of occasions, I remember scanning the prose the way a poet would scan it for rhythm. And to try to, so my attention was on words and on syllables and on the sound of the prose, hoping that that beneath any story, there's a kind of music that has to be there. And if the music isn't there, the story fails. It goes to the bottom of the ocean. Even if it's got a great plot and interesting action and interesting characters, without a kind of rhythm or music underneath it all, which is the water, the buoyant sound of language, stories will fail through awkwardness and clumsiness and gracelessness for all kinds of reasons. And so my attention really, whenever I'm writing, not just that story, but any story, is really at least as much on words, which ones to use and which ones not to use, than it is on the things you'd expect.
You had said that the sound of prose sometimes matters to you even more than that. You said, "I'll sacrifice the intended meaning of a sentence in order to achieve a more interesting sound." And
true.
Yeah, I really,
I'll sacrifice what I wanted to say for what the sound of what the next words should be, and they'll take me to a place that I didn't know I was going to go. That the content will change, what it comes out of a character's mouth will change. If what a character says is wooden or stilted or melodramatic or cliched, I'll get rid of it. And I'll try to get the sound of natural human speech, and that whatever comes out of the character's mouth then becomes the content of the story. And that's pretty... I didn't really realize this until I just said it, but that's the struggle and the fun of it for me, both. It's to listen to some inner self, a little gremlin inside of me that's becoming the story, and to pay attention to that sound of that voice and let it go where it wants to go. I don't think I'm alone in this. I don't think it's mystical or mysterious. I think many, maybe most writers of fiction are much like me. They try to listen to the sound of the language.
Is that something you think can be taught?
No, yeah. I don't.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think you can talk about it, but that's different from doing it and surrendering to music.
Yeah.
I don't think that Mozart was taught how to write a symphony. I think it came out of Mozartism, whatever's inside of Mozart, whatever makes Mozart Mozart, and the same with writers.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because I was just going to say it sounds exactly like a composer or a musician, that it's either in you or it isn't, and you can recognize it when it's happened, but teaching that part of it, I think, is a pretty elusive, perhaps pretty elusive
right.
struggle.
Louis Armstrong said essentially the same thing I'm saying, and as you're saying, that, you know, if you have to ask these kind of questions, how to do it, you're not going to be able to do it,
yeah.
and you shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
It comes from oneself.
I wonder if that is one of the components that, because the sort of verisimilitude of the things they carried, maybe some of the other works, but, you know, there's always this fascination by readers about what was true and what wasn't true, and kind of all that nonsense that I think of as nonsense because I don't really know what it matters, but... that play between, you know, you being the named narrator and what happened and what didn't happen. I'm wondering if that ties to our discussion about the language being the most important thing, and that being sort of your pathway into it being fiction as opposed to, you know, adhering to some
that's a good point.
Fact of truth.
That they do tie together. The sound of language is true. Whatever the sound is, that's the sound. The sound of a trombone is it's a C note is the sound of a trombone. And that's the truth. That truth is it's not a literary theory for me at all. It's just how my life has been led, that for every single thing I believe is true, a moment later I'll find an exception or a qualifier. And the issue of truth is less important to me. The literal truth is less important to me than the sound of truth. A baby crying, well, it can have the sound of hunger, it can have the sound of frustration, all kinds of causes. And it's the sound that of a baby in pain, and it has to be the sound. The issue of truth is sort of relative to the listener. If you hear pain in the voice, then it's a painful one, and you feed the baby. But if the sound is one of frustration, then you'll do something else. Or if the baby has wet himself or herself, then you'll do something else. You'll change a diaper. And sound carries a kind of truth. The sound of a bullet carries truth for someone when the bullet feels as if it's going to go right between your eyeballs. It carries its own truth.
One thing you said is really interesting, which is there is the truth of the sound itself, and then there is the truth of the receiver. So there is the truth of the writer, and there is the truth of the reader. And
absolutely,
that translation of what the writer is trying to say, even if it is completely accurate, is going to be morphed, or I don't know what there's a better word, through the translation to the, you know, through the psyche of the reader. So there's, you know, this whole conversation about truth is elusive anyway, you know.
Truth is a dangerous word.
Yeah.
Truth, that word kills people, literally. You know, the truths of Adolf Hitler killed a lot of people. To him, they were true. To us, as we listen to that kind of ridiculous rhetoric, it's untruthful, but in either case, what he saw as truth killed people. Same in so many different circumstances. And it can be a very dangerous word. It's used in kind of a common sense kind of way. There's truth and there's untruth. There's truth and there's falsity. But it partly depends on who's uttering it and who's listening to it.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Tim O'Brien. The book is The Thing, well, many of the books, one of the books that you've probably heard of is The Things They Carried. There's a whole wealth of books behind that as well. Let's just talk a little bit about idea generation. I know that you have said that just a snatch of language or an image can come to you that really can propel a book forward. I was reading that yesterday, and then I was laying in bed thinking, okay, image, come to me to make a novel, but it's that's a bit of an elusive exercise. But maybe we could take a couple, whatever you want, a couple of these novels or a couple of these the stories in The Things They Carried or the overall book itself, and talk a little bit about sort of the origin of where those novels started.
Well, it's a mysterious thing, and I have no idea where ideas are generated, like ideas for a plot or what a story should be, except to say that with one of my novels called In the Lake of the Woods, it began, much as others have, with a mysterious presence of an image that just dropped into my head out of the heavens, of a man and a woman lying on a porch in the dark, with the fog rolling in off a lake. And the image was an unhappy one. It was spooky and unhappy, a mixture of the two. What were they unhappy about? I had no idea. There was a painfulness happening in that fog as they lay on a porch outside beside some unknown lake. And the fog wrapping itself around them, seeming to contain pain. Well, it grew, and I wrote a few sentences describing what the image a little, or trying to capture the image, and listening to the sound of the fog and of their breathing and of their unhappiness. And words began to emerge out of the fog, coming out of the mouths of these two sad people. And where it came from, I have no idea. I didn't, as far as I know, feel any personal unhappiness, or I didn't feel any spookiness or any threat. It was simply there. But it engendered a feeling inside me, a feeling of I was afraid and wanted to feel what it was as I was writing the sentence, what I was afraid of, hence what they were afraid of. And a whole novel was born out of the unknown, this inexplicable image that came into my head one morning as I sat trying on sentences for size.
Did you experience moments of, I assume through all of these, you experienced these, the delightful moment of surprise for the writer where you're writing yourself saying, God, I never saw that coming. I never saw this character do that.
Happens all the time.
Yeah.
It's one of the joys of writing fiction and telling stories.
Yeah.
Is your own characters do things that are out of character. It's kind of an irony, I guess, but
right.
And those are the things that are, because human beings do the same. I act out of character sometimes, and my children do. We all do, and we surprise ourselves, and others surprise us. Sometimes joyfully and sometimes sadly, by the serendipity of acting out of character. It makes us human. Most snakes and chipmunks act in character, kind of all alike. And human beings have the capacity to be different at different periods of their lives. Sometimes moment by moment will change. We can go from happiness to depression in a heartbeat. But a snake is always a snake, and a chipmunk is always a chipmunk. And we humans are not snakes or chipmunks.
I'm going to reflect long and hard on this idea of the sound and cadence of language perhaps leading to these surprises. And, that the language itself can can reveal surprise in character that, you know, maybe if you're focused on that and you're not focused on what should my character do next in that sort of decision tree awfulness of people who outline their plots and it
well
never
said.
Works out. So maybe this attention to language as opposed to attention to plot is a key way to get away, tap into surprise, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I think you're right. I think that the writers who write stories and novels I like aren't programmatic. I think maybe even readers get the idea that somehow a novelist and a story writer develops an outline, as you said, and then simply executes it. So, but it, for me, I've never outlined in my life. That is to say, I haven't outlined a story, I haven't outlined a novel, and I haven't outlined my own life. I don't know what I'm going to do after you and I stop speaking. Will I have a heart attack, or will I get a phone call out of the blue from some old friend? And I wouldn't want to know. It would take away from the surprises of being alive. What if we knew what was going to happen to us 3 years from now exactly? You wouldn't want to live your life because it would be simply following an outline. And I try to treat my stories and my novels the same way, that open to hoping for surprise and hoping for that phone call out of the blue and paying attention to it when it happens.
Well, you must just love today's America. Because you wake up in the morning, you have no idea what's going
to I have no idea.
No one has any
idea. I have
idea.
No idea what I'm going to say when you ask a question until I start saying it. I'm very serious about that. I really don't know. I listen to you ask a question, and I'm thinking, oh, God, I'm empty. I have nothing. And then when you stop asking and I have to talk, words come out, and I'm surprised that anything intelligible does come out.
A lot of intelligible comes out. Yeah, I'm just thinking about this. I don't know. This is a whole other conversation, but I'm just thinking about living in today's America and the, you know, turning on CNN or whatever you turn on every morning and being shocked. And maybe our addiction to this, I don't know what's going to happen next. Anything could happen next. It's very exciting, you know, that maybe our animal brains mm-hmm. have become sort of addicted to that. You know, anything could happen and everything's up in a cocked hat and it is seductively addictive and you know, maybe
it is.
We've been getting that through fiction and now we're getting it through, you know, our daily news.
The world, yeah.
Yeah, the world. Yeah, that's interesting. My guest again is Tim O'Brien, a wealth of books, but among them In the Lake of the Woods, The Things They Carried. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I definitely want to be respectful of your time. So the moment that you're sick of me, you can just, you can hang up. But if you have a couple more minutes, I'd love to talk
sure.
also about your I know that you have said, and I guess it plays into everything we've been talking about, this sort of revision on a sentence-by-sentence basis, that you really have to get a sentence nailed down before you move on to the next, and somehow that can lead to losing a lot of really wonderful material before it. But when you get to the end of In the Lake of the Woods or at the end of The Things They Carried, is there yet another revision process after that, or is it pretty tight by the time you get to the final draft?
It keeps going.
Keeps going.
It
okay.
goes on and on. Sometimes I won't submit revisions to a publisher. I'll just think them and say, well, if I had a spare 20 minutes, I would do it. Other times I do. I slip in changes to my books. And no one notices because the story remains the same, essentially, But for me, it's a better book. In the end, what I think every writer hopes for is to leave behind for humanity the best present or gift that you can leave. And if you can change things to make it a better present or a better gift, you do it. You wouldn't give your child a birthday present that you thought was broken or inadequate. You'd try to buy a new one or make a new one. And I feel the same about my books, that they aren't sacred. Words are not there. They can be forever. They don't have to be anyway. And to try to make a thing that at least approaches excellence, even if it's not as excellent as you wish it were.
I know at least The Things They Carried was re-released on its 20th anniversary. And did you take that opportunity to make any changes to that, or was that...
I certainly did.
Oh, you did.
I went through the whole book and made a lot of changes. Usually just a word here and a word there. But sometimes a phrase, sometimes a sentence, sometimes a deletion. Modest changes, but to me, there is no such thing as a modest change. They seem modest to others, but to the writer, they feel necessary.
Yeah. I'm always fascinated by this, I guess, kind of philosophical idea of the more you play with a memory and you turn it over in your head and you revisit it and you write about it, each touch against the memory changes it into something else. And
it does.
And kind of through this 45-year process of processing this war, I mean, I know it must have changed for you, but I don't know what my question is here, but do you feel very differently about it today than you felt about it in the 70s?
I wouldn't say very differently, no. I mean, in the gross macro sense, I feel pretty much the war was unwinnable, and America should not go around telling people the kind of government they should have. And if you certainly not to kill 3 million people for reasons that now seem pretty suspect. In modest memory ways, though, things do change over time. You recall things you'd forgotten, and in my case, things I'd forgotten for decades. I'll have a conversation with an ex-buddy with whom I served, and he'll mention something, and a light will go off in my head, and memory will be instantly there. And in that sense, you kind of improve on your memory through conversations with friends, or you restore your memory. And that's been a neat experience in meeting with old war buddies, that you kind of rediscover yourself and rediscover what you'd been through, because you obliterated it, or time had eradicated it from your memory. And suddenly you're back where you were as a 22-year-old, and it's hard thing to describe, but there's a feeling of like refinding yourself and refinding your own history. Oh yeah, I lived through that, and I did do that, or I did see that. And that's not just true of war, of course. It's true of all our lives. You meet an old childhood friend and whose name you may not have thought of in 50 years or 30 or 20 years, and just the name, Elroy Birdall or whatever the name might be, you'll suddenly remember how Elroy stole your turtle when you were 8 years old, and how your dad went over to Elroy's house and made his father make Elroy give you the turtle back. That's a real example that actually happened. Simply hearing the name of an old childhood friend brought back this memory of a stolen turtle I'd totally forgotten. And memories associated with it that were important, that sense of loss. I loved that turtle, and I knew who took it, but it was Elroy. I knew it, but I couldn't prove it. And I asked my dad about it. He went over to Elroy's house and knocked on the door and said to Elroy's father, "I think your son stole my son's turtle." And the father of Elroy went and found the turtle and gave it back. All of this had been obliterated. My sense of, God, I loved that turtle, and it was gone. And my sense of being outraged and angry and really depressed at the loss of all that had vanished, and just two words brought it back, the guy's name.
It is funny how those childhood things are so, like, I don't know, they're just so deep in you. I mean, you had told a story about getting lost in the woods as a kid for a couple of hours, and I don't know if those memories as a kid, because you don't have kind of any context and you've never had that experience before, and so everything's new and extra scary because you've never been through it. But yeah, your ability to call up those experiences with such like emotion in childhood is so, and I would think in war too, because that's another, you know, you've never been in that situation before. The stakes couldn't possibly be higher. And so,
And the same is true of fathers and mothers and of boyfriends and girlfriends and wives and husbands, that even though you may have forgotten a great deal, that there are certain primitive emotions of love and joy and fear that are engendered by events. And if you forget the event, you've sort of lost a part of yourself. And if you recover it, you've found a part of yourself. And I think, in a way, that's what novels and stories are for, that through a novel and through a story, as you read it, as a reader, you're recapturing a part of yourself through what you see happening to other characters on the page. I don't read stories just to see what happens in the story. If it's a good story, it does something to my own sense of self and my own sense of who I once was and who I am now, and we find ourselves inside of books.
Does this translate into your belief that writers should write a little bit about what they know versus taking too many leaps into the complete unknown, or no?
I think we can't write about things that we're completely, with which we have no experience.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, at least for me, it's not possible, that I have experience with joy, and I have experience with pain, and I have experience with lost love, and I have experience with found love. And as we all do, that's what I meant by the word kind of primitive, the things we share that are universal. And although a story is specific in its details and so on, it generates in readers, you hope, if it's well executed, it generates deep-seated things that are important for all of us.
Yeah.
Using your example of being lost, there are all kinds of ways of being lost. Physical ways, you're lost in a forest or you're lost in the city streets. But there's lostness, spiritual lostness, that all of us go through, these crises of who am I and what is my life for and where am I going and why am I in this bed late at night all by myself crying, that kind of lostness. And stories, as you read a story, it makes you feel as if you're part of this, these very deep and universally shared emotional experiences that make us human.
Yeah. So speaking of who you read, who do you read? I mean, who is kind of tops your list of favorite people that you think give good examples of this?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow that.
Oh, I'm sorry. You were talking about the stories you read and the novels that you've loved, and I was just wondering if you could give a couple of examples of some of your favorites who have... I know.
For everyone I say, there'll be 10 trillion I've forgotten or ignored or omitted. Goodness.
Well, I don't have to put you on the spot.
Well, I mean, I've just finished a new book. It'll be coming out in October, and four of the chapters I deal with the writing of Ernest Hemingway. And I reread all of Hemingway recently, a writer I'd read as an adolescent, and then later in college, and then later as a young adult, and later as a mid-age adult, and now I've returned to again. Not because Hemingway is any more important to me than many, many other writers, in fact, less important to me, And I read a story called Now I Lay Me, and the story is about a man lying in a hospital, World War One. He's been wounded, and he's hearing the silkworms up in the trees munching away and munching away, just these little worms, but millions of them. And he, which generates in me a sense of death eating away at us. There's a war on in this story, and people are dying, and this guy has to go back to the war once he recovers. And it's the finality that we all face, those silkworms eating away relentlessly, the way time relentlessly eats away at all of us until there's nothing left to eat for those worms, and we're dead. And it's a universal experience, and it's an example of a story in its detail that goes way beyond the detail of, it's not, the story's not about worms. it's about what those worms are going to do to all the trees and the leaves,
and eventually
and,
us.
And it's really a very short story, but a very beautiful story.
I think it's interesting to take these passes through mortality. I mean, you know, my dad died last year, but this sort of experience of the mortality press that he felt at that time and the mortality press that you feel at the end of your life, how different and yet similar those two experiences are, and kind of this, I think really interesting things can come out of this meditation on mortality. I mean, how it happens is obviously very different. The context is very different, but the, so, you know, some of the fears and ways that you can reflect on it are pretty similar. And I think a lot of,
I'd say more than pretty. I'd say very similar.
You were talking about writing a couple of years ago. You were talking about writing sort of your stories for your sons. You have younger sons and wanting to leave them something behind. Is that still a project you're working on?
That's the book I've just
finished. That is the book you just finished. Okay. I can't believe you have a book out in October, and I screwed this up. I should have, we can have you back on.
I can't either.
Are you finding your sort of areas of concern changing as you you've been writing over these decades, or do you find yourself kind of interested in different things as you're getting older, or do you still kind of find the themes that you were interested in back then still intriguing?
I'm the same. I mean, the same things that I worried about when I was a little boy, I worry about and think about now. The same things that gave me pleasure as a little boy give me pleasure now. As a little boy, for example, I loved magic, doing magic tricks, and I still do. It's my hobby. And it's very much like what I do for a living, writing books, stories. It's illusion. Those aren't real people in the page. They're made up characters, and the story is invented, and the dialogue is, and yet there's the illusion as you read a book, and if you like the book, that it's happening before your eyes, and you're almost in it. You're a very close eyewitness. Unlike, say, the movies where there's a certain distance and you're watching Robert De Niro do a thing or Al Pacino, in a book, you're making up your own Robert De Niro and your own Al Pacino, and you're in the illusion. Even though it's not real, it feels real. You don't read a book and think, well, that's not happening, that's not happening, that's not happening. If you read a book that way, you'd go insane. And you surrender to it. And it feels, until you put the book down, it feels as if it's happening, if it's a good book. And that's something that I've been part of my personality from the time I was a kid, is living in fantasy and living in my daydreams living in my thoughts as I make my way through a day. Even as a kid, I thought about this sort of thing, and I still do.
That's interesting, the connection between novel writing and magic. My husband's also a sleight of hand magician, I mean by hobby, but yeah, there's sort of a narrative story around a trick, usually. And
almost always, if it's any good.
Right.
A bad magician will just do a trick, and it just you see the trick and there's no narrative around it. A good magician does build a narrative.
It is interesting to see the way magic and that practice has kind of permeated all the other aspects of his life. He doesn't write, but now that I'm thinking about, you know, the principles of magic and applying those to novel writing, I'll have to meditate on that more. But that's really interesting.
There's a lot to meditate on. I mean, just the whole idea of mystery at the heart of the human character and how it's inexplicable. You can try to pin it down, but even about ourselves, I'm not sure if we're not all mysteries to ourselves, at least to a degree. I don't know why I do the things I do. I'm a mystery to myself. And it's the mystery that is fascinating. And if I could say, well, Tim, here's why you are the way you are, I don't know if it would be time to leave the earth and die. Because it's so fixed and it's so deterministic, and I don't think the human creature is really that way.
Right. So let's spend our last couple of minutes together talking about maybe advice that you'd give to writers. I know you recommend putting books away for a little while and letting them sort of germinate and coming back to them with fresh eyes. Is that kind of a standard practice? Yeah. How long do you...
I put chapters away, and I put sometimes for a couple of years I'll put sentences away and just stop writing and let something happen, hoping something will happen. I wouldn't call it a trick exactly or a technique, and I wouldn't recommend it to other people. But it's how I've had to do it oftentimes, is let something be. The way you'd let a baby grow in a mother's womb and hope the baby comes out. And sometimes it's 9 months, sometimes it's 9 days, sometimes it's 9 minutes. But the waiting for me is important, and not to try to have a forced birth.
Yeah. Do you abandon many projects, let them go?
Many more than I finish, yes.
Really? How do you know when it's time to do that?
When I wait and nothing, the baby isn't born, and I don't expect it to be born, I'll kind of hope it's later on, but I'll move on to something else.
Are you still, do you teach? I know you're teaching at Sewanee.
Hardly
at all. Okay.
I teach 6 times a year. I go in for 2 hours and that's it.
Okay. And you're doing Sewanee this year.
Not that I don't like it. I do like it, but the problem is it consumes so much time, and you have to devote yourself entirely to a manuscript by a student, and I have to feel like I've memorized it, so I don't make silly mistakes when I'm talking about it, forget a character's name or forget what happens. And it consumes such huge chunks of time that I finally had to really, maybe 10 years ago, really cut back radically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You'd be the best teacher to have. That's a shame. But you are doing Sewanee this year, are you not? Are you doing that?
I am. Yep.
Okay. Is that, I guess that would be a much different sort of environment than a system.
I dread it in a way. I mean, it's so much work of the kind I just described of this. Only it's not just 20 pages or 15, it's 60 pages. And then there are 8 manuscripts, and you can do the math in your head, and that's a lot of pages to read and reread and reread so that you feel comfortable. remembering everything.
Yeah. Was your time consulting either with, well, I know the This Is Us project has to be absolutely entirely different than the Ken Burns project, but is that a something that sort of feeds you and is enjoyable to you, or is that strictly a favor for the people who ask?
Well, a good question, and I'm not sure I know the answer. Yeah. Partly it's enjoyable if you feel you can help. It's the helping part that I worry about. That there has to be a feeling that, it, for me at least, that it, the, there's a prospect of some felicitous result, that the promise is there, or there's a glimmer that this could result in a genuine piece of art. And if the promise isn't there, and the glimmer isn't there, I can go through the motions of helping, but without the feeling that much will come of it, that because the glimmer of a happy ending doesn't seem present. So it's on a student-by-student basis for me, really, as to whether I feel good about it or not.
Well, I can't believe we're out of time, but if there's, was there something we should have said that we didn't say? We've said,
well, it was a fast hour, I'll tell you that. Almost an hour. No, I mean, it feels like you asked the questions I would have wanted asked.
Excellent. Well, now that I know you have, I don't know how I missed that you had a book coming out later in the year, but perhaps we can resume our chat. That would be lovely.
I'd love that.
I'd love that.
Great.
Too. I'd love that.
How
too.
Do you pronounce? Is it Marie or Mary? I can't tell from how
I know. Written. Crazy 70s parents. It's Marie.
Okay.
I pronounce it as
though. I guessed that. That's
exactly.
A guess.
You did exactly.
When Andre sent his message to me about you, he told me how great you were and how great the program was. But when you read a message, you can't get pronunciation.
Right.
From the spelling.
I know. No, Andre's.
Maybe your mom.
That was my interview with Tim O'Brien. That's all the time we have for this week. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.